GM, Hughes Aircraft, Honeywell, Hazelton Corporation, General Telephone and Electronics, Sylvania Electric, General Avionics, and so forth. One thing that, to answer that more specific, if people in any community that any of you are in would like to know what production of weapons like this and other weapons for Vietnam and parts of the automated battlefield and so forth, what's going on in your community, if you write to us at NARMIC, we have quite a bit of detailed sources from the industries involved in war production that state very explicitly all the contracts that are awarded for any county in the country for each quarter of the year. And also we have a book, Weapons for Counterinsurgency, that just goes into some of the weapons we showed pictures of here, and the chemical and biological weapons, anti-incendiaries like napalm, and talks about who the contractors are and how to organize a project against one of the corporations producing these. Except that this is rather outdated as far as the explicit contracts. The general background's still the same, but you should write to NARMIC if you want to actually organize a project. And also, we're going to write a new updated book on this and on the automated battlefield. And if any of you vets have had experience in using intrusion detection things or seeing firsthand uses of these anti-personnel weapons, I'd appreciate very much if you'd let me or Vince Pinto of our staff interview you for this book we'll be coming up with.
Okay, Art. We have time for just one more question. I'm getting signals from all over the place. Fellow there with the checkered shirt, could you speak up, please?
I'm sorry, the statistics have not been made public to foreigners as to the number of deaths in North Vietnam by U.S. bombs. All I can say is that the North Vietnamese insist that the overwhelming majority, as I said in my original presentation, of persons killed were women and children. Two-thirds were women and non-combatant women and children, but they have not given any precise statistics except to the people of Vietnam itself. That is, each locality has been informed of the number of deaths in their area. And these have not been published because it would give the CIA information that it does not, it should not have.
All right, we're going to have to conclude with that. The 3rd Marine Division will testify next, and if you'll keep that area down here by the door fairly clear, we can all get out and get in quick. Thank you very, very much.
I was there at the little bighorn. I heard many men lying. I saw many more dying. But I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? From the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers, so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men. Now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won. the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese sky. Set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leader's screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason. Call it love or call it reason. But I ain't marching anymore.
Palante was presented on recording. In New York, you're tuned to listener-supported radio, WBAI-FM at 99.5.
The George Hamilton Combs program will not be heard at this hour in order that we may bring you live from the White House a special message by the President of the United States. Mr. Nixon tonight will present new proposals aimed at ending the Vietnam War. In advance of his address, the president said his speech tonight will be the most comprehensive statement ever made on this subject. The proposals will be presented formally to the communist delegation at the Paris Truce Talks tomorrow. There's speculation that he'll ask that military operations be halted at their present stage. And it's also believed that Mr. Nixon will offer to speed up the pullout of Americans from Vietnam. And now here is Mr. Nixon.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I would like to talk to you about a major new initiative for peace. When I authorized operations against the enemy sanctuaries in Cambodia last April, I also directed that an intensive effort be launched to develop new approaches for peace in Indochina. In Ireland on Sunday, I met with the chiefs of our delegation to the Paris talks. This meeting marked the culmination of a government-wide effort begun last spring on the negotiation front. After considering the recommendations of all my principal advisors, I am tonight announcing new proposals for peace in Indochina. This new peace initiative has been discussed with the governments of South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. All support it. It has been made possible in large part by the remarkable success of the Vietnamization program over the past 18 months. Tonight I want to tell you what these proposals are and what they mean. First, I propose that all armed forces throughout Indochina cease firing their weapons and remain in the positions they now hold. This would be a ceasefire in place. It would not in it itself be an end to the conflict, but it would accomplish one goal all of us have been working toward, an end to the killing. I do not minimize the difficulty of maintaining a ceasefire in a guerrilla war where there are no front lines, but an unconventional war may require an unconventional truce. Our side is ready to stand still and cease firing. I ask that this proposal for a ceasefire in place be the subject for immediate negotiation. And my hope is that it will break the logjam in all the negotiations. This ceasefire proposal is put forth without preconditions. The general principles that should apply are these. A ceasefire must be effectively supervised by international observers as well as by the parties themselves. Without effective supervision, a ceasefire runs the constant risk of breaking down. All concerned must be confident that the ceasefire will be maintained and that any local breaches of it will be quickly and fairly repaired. The ceasefire should not be the means by which either side builds up its strength by an increase in outside combat forces in any of the nations of Indochina. And a ceasefire should cause all kinds of warfare to stop. This covers the full range of actions that have typified this war, including bombing and acts of terror. A ceasefire should encompass not only the fighting in Vietnam, but in all of Indochina. Conflicts in this region are closely related. The United States has never sought to widen the war. What we do seek is to widen the peace. Finally, a ceasefire should be part of a general move to end the war in Indochina. A ceasefire in place would undoubtedly create a host of problems in its maintenance. But it's always been easier to make war than to make a truce. To build an honorable peace, we must accept the challenge of long and difficult negotiations. By agreeing to stop the shooting, we can set the stage for agreements on other matters. A second point of the new initiative for peace is this. I propose an Indochina peace conference. At the Paris talks today, we're talking about Vietnam. But North Vietnamese troops are not only infiltrating, crossing borders, and establishing bases in South Vietnam, they are carrying on their aggression in Laos and Cambodia as well. An international conference is needed to deal with the conflict in all three states of Indochina. The war in Indochina has been proved to be of one piece. It cannot be cured by treating only one of its areas of outbreak. The essential elements of the Geneva Accords of 1954 and 1962 remain valid as a basis for settlement of problems between states in the Indochina area. And we shall accept the results of agreements reached between these states. While we pursue the convening of an Indochina peace conference, we will continue the negotiations in Paris. Our proposal for a larger conference can be discussed there as well as through other diplomatic channels. The Paris talks will remain our primary forum for reaching a negotiated settlement until such time as a broader international conference produces serious negotiations. The third part of our peace initiative has to do with the United States forces in South Vietnam. In the past 20 months, I have reduced our troop ceilings in South Vietnam by 165,000 men. During the spring of next year, these withdrawals will total more than 260,000 men, about one half the number that were in South Vietnam when I took office. As the American combat role and presence have decreased, American casualties have also decreased. Our casualties since the completion of the Cambodian operation were the lowest for a comparable period in the last 4.5 years. We are ready now to negotiate an agreed timetable for complete withdrawals as part of an overall settlement. We are prepared to withdraw all our forces as part of a settlement based on the principles I spelled out previously and the proposals I am making tonight. Fourth, I ask the other side to join us in a search for a political settlement that truly meets the aspirations of all South Vietnamese. Three principles govern our approach. We seek a political solution that reflects the will of the South Vietnamese people. A fair political solution should reflect the existing relationship of political forces in South Vietnam. And we will abide by the outcome of the political process agreed upon. Let there be no mistake about one essential point. The other side is not merely objecting to a few personalities in the South Vietnamese government. They want to dismantle the organized non-communist parties and ensure the takeover by their party. They demand the right to exclude whomever they wish from government. This patently unreasonable demand is totally unacceptable. As my proposals today indicate, we are prepared to be flexible on many matters, but we stand firm for the right of all the South Vietnamese people to determine for themselves the kind of government they want. We have no intention of seeking any settlement at the conference table other than one which fairly meets the reasonable concerns of both sides. We know that when the conflict ends, the other side will still be there. And the only kind of settlement that will endure is one that both sides have an interest in preserving. Finally, I propose the immediate and unconditional release of all prisoners of war held by both sides. War and imprisonment should be over for all these prisoners. They and their families have already suffered too much. I propose that all prisoners of war, without exception, without condition, be released now to return to the place of their choice. And I propose that all journalists and other innocent civilian victims of the conflict be released immediately as well. The immediate release of all prisoners of war would be a simple act of humanity, but it could be even more. It could serve to establish good faith, the intent to make progress, and thus improve the prospects for negotiation. We are prepared to discuss specific procedures to complete the speedy release of all prisoners. The five proposals that I have made tonight can open the door to an enduring peace in Indochina. Ambassador Bruce will present these proposals formally to the other side in Paris tomorrow. He will be joined in that presentation by Ambassador Lam, representing South Vietnam. Let us consider for a moment what the acceptance of these proposals would mean. Since the end of World War II, there's always been a war going on somewhere in the world. The guns have never stopped firing. By achieving a ceasefire in Indochina, and by holding firmly to the ceasefire in the Middle East, we could hear the welcome sound of peace throughout the world for the first time in a generation. We could have some reason to hope that we had reached the beginning of the end of war in this century. We might then be on the threshold of a generation of peace. The proposals I made tonight are designed to end the fighting throughout Indochina and to end the impasse in negotiations in Paris. Nobody has anything to gain by delay, and only lives to lose. There are many nations involved in the fighting in Indochina. Tonight, all those nations, except one, announce their readiness to agree to a ceasefire. The time has come for the government of North Vietnam to join its neighbors in a proposal to quit making war and to start making peace. As you know, I've just returned from a trip which took me to Italy, Spain, Yugoslavia, England, and Ireland. Hundreds of thousands of people cheered me as I drove through the cities of those countries. They were not cheering for me as an individual. They were cheering for the country I was proud to represent, the United States of America. For millions of people in the free world, the non-aligned world, and the communist world, America is the land of freedom, of opportunity, of progress. I believe there's another reason they welcomed me so warmly. In every country I visited, despite their wide differences in political systems and national backgrounds, in my talks with leaders all over the world, I find that there are those who may not agree with all of our policies. But no world leader to whom I have talked fears that the United States will use its great power to dominate another country or to destroy its independence. We can be proud that this is the cornerstone of America's foreign policy. There is no goal to which this nation is more dedicated, and to which I am more dedicated, than to build a new structure of peace in the world, where every nation, including North Vietnam as well as South Vietnam, can be free and independent with no fear of foreign aggression or foreign domination. I believe every American deeply believes in his heart that the proudest legacy the United States can leave during this period when we are the strongest nation of the world is that our power was used to defend freedom not to destroy it, to preserve the peace, not to break the peace. It is in that spirit that I make this proposal for a just peace in Vietnam and in Indochina. I ask that the leaders in Hanoi respond to this proposal in the same spirit. Let us give our children what we have not had in this century, a chance to enjoy a generation of peace. Thank you. Good night.
You've heard a message to the nation from President Nixon concerning the Vietnam War. Mr. Nixon has just proposed a standstill ceasefire in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, immediate release of all prisoners, and a broadened peace conference to seek a settlement of conflict throughout all of Indochina. This has been a presentation of WOR News.
From 11 to 11:30 is listed in the folio as to be announced. And during this time, we will hear Bruce Soloway talking with Jennifer Dorn about her recent visit with Timothy Leary and Eldridge Cleaver in Algeria and the Mideast.
This is Timothy Leary speaking to you from Lama Drug, a beautiful fishing port outside of Algiers, Algeria. My escape from prison and Rosemary and my escape from the country was engineered, executed, designed, and aesthetically carried off by the noble and beautiful Weatherman Underground. And since we have been in Algeria, we have been under the wise, benign, and loving protection of the Black Panthers, led by the genial genius, Eldridge Cleaver. It is true that in the company of Field Marshal DC of the Black Panther Party, and Jennifer Dorn, and Marty Kenner, I embarked on an adventurous trip throughout the Middle East to visit the Palestinian guerrillas. All statements that we were ejected from Arab countries or received hostily are distortions and lies by the wicked pig capitalist bourgeois press. We were received every place with fraternal arms.
That tape was brought back from Algiers by Jennifer Dorn and a delegation of people from the Youth International Party and the Black Panther Defense Committee in New York. And I have with me in the studio right now Jennifer Dorn, and she and I will talk for a while about what happened on that trip through the Mideast and through Algeria. I think the impression that most people have, after having read the press reports of your voyage throughout the Mideast, that you had a lot of trouble and you weren't met with a very friendly response, but according to the tape from Dr. Leary and the press conference you held last week, the press reports weren't entirely accurate.
That's right. When I came back and read about the trip in the press, it was like another trip. We were really treated very brutally by the press in the Middle East, by the Western press, and they really made our trip very dangerous, especially for Timothy and DC's lives, both of whom are fugitives.
How do you mean?
Well, the trip originally started, six of us went from the United States to Algiers, and we were going to greet the international section of the Black Panther Party and to meet with Eldridge and Kathleen Cleaver and to celebrate the freeing of Timothy Leary from prison in the United States and his escape with his wife, Rosemary, by the Weatherman Underground. We originally went over there just to stay in Algiers. And when we got there, we decided we were going to hold a press conference to celebrate Tim's birthday. what happened, there was some confusion within the Algerian government. They didn't quite realize that it was going to be as big a thing as it turned out to be. And within one day, we thought we would just call a press conference, and a day later, we'd have a press conference. Well, it turned out that there were no flights into Algiers, and we were getting calls from all over the United States. Everyone wanted to come in, and people had their crews in different parts of Europe. So the Algerian government decided that it would be best to send four of us on a trip to the Middle East to meet with the Palestinian guerrillas. And on this trip, Tim could surface and issue a public statement, and we would come back, and then we could have a press conference in Algeria. It would give them time to straighten it out. So the trip was originally arranged by the Algerian government and Al-Fatah leadership in Algiers. We left for the Middle East. It took two days to get to Beirut, and when we arrived in Beirut, we were supposed to be met by Al-Fatah leadership. When we got there, they weren't there. And for the next several days, we tried to make contact. We couldn't make contact with Algeria.
What happened?
It was very confusing. Well, lines, I mean, it takes like 8 hours to get a call through to Algeria. Eldridge, in the meantime, had gotten in contact with the head of Al-Fatah in Jordan, I believe, and they were trying to reach the Lebanese members of Al-Fatah. And there was just a breakdown in communication. No one quite understood exactly why we were there, because the Lebanese people hadn't been informed. And the press found out that we were there. On the plane from Cairo to Beirut, turned out that there was a UPI reporter who recognized Timothy. And when we arrived in Beirut, we thought we were unknown, and it was already out over the wire that we were there. Then the next day when we got up,
actually got into the city.
Right. We got visas, and we decided the next day that we would contact Al-Fatah. We asked the government authorities in Lebanon for the name of a hotel, and they gave us a name, and we went there and went to sleep, not knowing that we ended up in the hotel for the center of all the Western press in the Middle East. It turned out that CBS had the room next to us. And so the press wanted a story very bad, and scenes developed literally where I would open the door to the hotel room and would be fighting off 20 reporters who would be trying to drag me out into the hall. People were trying to climb up the side of the hotel to get in the bedroom windows. It was a very dangerous situation. It sounds funny when I tell stories about it now, but it was like comparable. Being in Beirut was comparable, for example, to having Timothy Leary run around in O'Hare Airport now. I mean, it was that dangerous.
Did the Lebanese government know what they were getting you into when they put you up there, do you think?
I don't know. I have no idea. I know that we were never asked to leave the country. At one point, we decided that we were going to go on into Damascus, and we met a reporter who was a good friend of Marty Kenner's from several years ago, a man named Abdullah Schleifer, who used to live in New York and became a Muslim and moved to the Middle East. And he has a lot of contact with the guerrilla movements. So he arranged to get a car for us to go to Damascus in the middle of the night. The problem was that we had to get Timothy out of the hotel without being noticed, because he didn't have traveling papers, and we had heard rumors that the U.S. authorities were going to move on him. There's no extradition treaty in Lebanon, but it turns out to be the center for all kinds of CIA kidnappings and murders, and anything goes if you have money in the city. So we decided at one point that we would call a press conference, which DC and Marty and I would give, and that would give time for Timothy to leave the hotel, and we would meet up later and go into Syria. Well, we really underestimated how bad the press wanted their story. We held this press conference where we timed DC and my entering the press room at a certain time, and 2 minutes later Timothy would take an elevator down and sneak out a side door. So at 7 o'clock we took this elevator down to the main floor of the hotel, and went to the elevator doors opened, and we were greeted by all these cameras going and lights and stuff. So we charged through this main lobby and turn around, and no one's following us. So it turned out that they already knew about our plan, and 2 minutes later, Timothy arrives in the same elevator. The door is open, and he's caught by the press. So we gave a very brief press conference. Meanwhile, they literally chased him all over Beirut. At one point, he ended up fleeing from the taxi and running into an apartment building, going into a Lebanese janitor's apartment where they were having dinner, picking up the baby, running for the back room, and the press broke down at the door.